Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello and welcome to our new edition of The Vicar and the Witch. So we ended last time with Maggie speaking about the birth of a new baby, and I was all of a quiver to hear more. So please, Maggie, tell me what you're talking about.
Well, this is the birth of the universe or creation in the Jewish mystical tradition, and I have freely admit that I have interpreted it myself for the feminine tradition because that's my job. But Kabbalistic teacher, Kabbalah just means received wisdom. So it's the oral tradition of the Jewish tradition and following on the Christian tradition, the tradition of the mystics. And it starts off by saying that God wished to behold God, which sounds like an odd phrase. God wished to recreate itself. And I sort of went into meditation with that and sat and said, I need a way to understand that better. And what I got back was, well, you understand how somebody can be so happy in themselves and in their relationship with themselves that they want to give birth to share this with another. So the teaching can be summed up as saying that God was so in love with love that it decided to create a baby of itself so that it could experience the whole growth of this baby, understanding and experiencing absolutely everything, but in the physical, which God isn't. So then there was a process known as Zimzum, where God had to create a space within itself for the new life to be grown, and that would be the womb, and then breathed in what we would call the helix of the DNA of the universe into that space, and all of creation is flowing from that. The primordial human being is known as Adam Kadmon, and that is the divine baby of the whole universe. Usually Kabbalists stick to the humanity aspect of it, but if you look at the diagrams which have been woven from the menorah in the Hebrew Testament through the 11th century up to today, you can actually see that humanity takes one place, one role in the diagram of Adam Kadmon, and the rest of it is the whole of creation. So one of the loveliest things behind it that I like is that Atzilut, which is the top world, also known as Adam Kadmon, is the place where everything that has ever been loved still exists in pure eternity. And as God loves everything, that means everything still exists at that very, very high level and could incarnate again on another planet or somewhere else.
So as I remember it, this is a thing that you were speaking about as happening in the future. And to me, this is a thing, and I'm sure to you, the way you've described it, this is a thing that has already happened. This is what we're in.
We're in it, yes.
Were you suggesting by, I mean, I might have misunderstood. This wouldn't be the first time. But you seem to be saying that kind of mankind was progressing towards a place, or the universe was progressing towards a place where this would happen. And so are you speaking to, in a way, a sense of the great wheel of the eons of time going round and round and round with divine creation birthing and rebirthing this world, or many worlds, all worlds,
all worlds.
And over again in a kind of great circle?
I would say all worlds. I mean, early Kabbalists, of course, only knew about planet Earth. They didn't even really know it was a planet. Many of them thought it was flat. So they assumed that the stars were archangels, and that everything that they could see had a life force, but they had no concept that there were other suns and other planets that people could be born on. So the great thing about Kabbalah and mysticism, it has to update for the understanding of the generation. And now we have got NASA and science and the Hubble telescope, it's quite obvious that this plan is vast. And I sometimes chuckle to myself at what Orthodox Christians are going to do if they do find life on another planet and have to work out that Jesus came to save them too. But pardon me for that. But Kabbalah teaches that humanity, we're all still babies. This is a very, very young universe, according to Kabbalah. Humanity itself is said to be approximately 2 years old as a species, which means we're in the phase of breaking our toys and having tantrums, which kind of fits. But it just fits around so beautifully. If you think of this idea of the whole of creation being much older than Orthodox Christianity likes to say, the fundamentalists like to say it's only 4,000 years old and that the dinosaurs were stuck in fossils just to tempt us. And when you stop laughing at that, you really are going to want to bang your head against the wall, because it makes it as though humanity is the only human thing, as though the Elohim was just farting around doing nothing until humanity turned up and nothing else was important. And I think that's the fundamental problem that we have in many religions, this idea that because we humans are conscious of being conscious, we're the only thing God cares about. And I cannot see any validation for that at all.
No, I obviously fundamentally disagree with that on every imaginable level. So, yeah, just to go back with what you were just saying about God created, the divine created, out of love, from a desire to experience, that to me that speaks very strongly to a question that we were asked on Facebook, you and I, underneath our kind of, you know, Podbean thing, was that somebody was asking about parthenogenesis. And to me, that act of creation is the primary parthenogenic act. Out of unity became birth, you know. So in my animist and therefore remarkably easy to describe in extremely simplistic and kind of mechanistic terms, the one split herself in two, mated with herself, as it were, as now two, and created three. And from that very, very, very simple story comes all of matter, mater, mother. And that it just seems like, I don't know, I mean, my ignorance of other people's ways is almost limitless in its scope, but it does seem to me that every creation story begins at this point.
I would agree. And don't you ever dare call yourself ignorant again, my friend, because ignorant is to ignore, and you're inquiring. You are not ignorant. You may be innocent in places, but you are not ignorant.
Thank you. Yes, I do acknowledge that correct definition of ignorance.
Wonderful. Well, if I can go back, and because I think it was Sandy who asked about how on earth could a parthenogenesis produce a male?
Yes,
because in the physical world nowadays, parthenogenesis doesn't produce a male. It produces another female, I think. But my lack of knowledge of science is fairly profound. However, if you go into the mystical tradition again, it actually does try and explain this in the words in the Bible. And I don't speak Hebrew, but thank God I've got friends who do. And you can see it woven through Genesis, even though Genesis was edited by the Second Temple folk. It's still there because they didn't know what to cut out, which is very helpful. We start off with Bereshit Elohim. The Elohim creates, or weaves, according to Origen. And Elohim is a feminine noun with a masculine plural ending. And that is unusual, but in Hebrew, what's very interesting with the word womb and the word earth also are feminine nouns with masculine endings. And this is very unusual in Hebrew, but I think the intent is to show that in that line of teaching anyway, it's an androgynous start point. And so it's the feminine that gives birth out of the androgynous start point, but the androgynous start point is always androgynous. It contains all aspects to it. Does that make sense?
So it makes perfect sense. I'm intrigued by that in two opposing directions at once. So first of all, I just want to say that the feminine word given a masculine ending, that's something that happened to our old words for witches across Europe through the duration of the time from the arrival of Christianity to, you know, the supposed extinction of our ancient animist ways, is that all of those wonderful magical words that were, might have become sorceress, enchantress, seer, wise woman, witch, you know, this hag, countless words in the original Anglo-Saxon, in the old German, in these older languages, as they evolve through time and as Christianity takes root, these absolutely feminine words are often given a masculine plural as part of their kind of obfuscation. So I'm very intrigued by that.
How interesting.
And yeah. I wonder, is it a later addition? Is it obfuscation? Or is that, I mean, the,
that's,
you know,
a very good question. And you know, we're never going to know because there's only one version of the Hebrew Old Testament now. They honed it down to one so that people couldn't take it off into flights of fantasy. But we'll never, ever know. But there is actually a clue, because in the creation of the universe, we have the Elohim, which is the feminine, again with this odd ending. Then when she creates humanity, she's referred to as Yahweh Elohim. So it's like this androgynous being has then started to split. And this is when she creates the androgynous Adama, which is then broken into two. It's a side, not a rib, so she's not necessarily lesser than him. Into Adam and Eve, it's still Yahweh Elohim. And the whole story of the Tree of Knowledge, which is such a beautiful one in the mystical tradition, it's just teaching people about cause and effect. It's still Yahweh Elohim. But then after Adam and Eve leave Eden and get down onto the physical earth, Eve says, I have gotten a man from the Lord, when she gives birth. So on the one hand, from then on, it's Yahweh. The Lord means Yahweh. So most of the stuff, though there's 10 names for God in the Hebrew Testament, most of the ferocious stuff that we know about comes from Yahweh. But what fascinates me is, even though we know Genesis was heavily edited after the divine feminine was thrown out of the first temple, it still is. Eve says, I have gotten a man from the Lord, which is coming back to this mother of the king, wife of the king aspect again. And I saw the most beautiful definition of this in a fiction book by Jodie Taylor, who's one of my favourite authors. She's written a series called The Chronicles of St. Mary about historians investigating what's happened in history in contemporary time, and don't you dare call it time travel, as she puts it. And they're visiting Minoan Crete just before the earthquake and the volcanic eruption that destroyed Knossos. And she's viewing one of the bull tournaments. And she's talking about the king and the priestess who sit together to watch the contest. And she just wrote it saying, the two thrones were level. The priestess, because this is the land of the mother. The king, because he rules with her blessing. Isn't that lovely?
It's a beautiful description of sovereignty and service, as I understand it.
Yes.
Sovereignty is the land. Service is that force which protects the land.
Yes, absolutely. And that can go, God, I'll have to shut up in a minute because I'm rambling, but you'll have heard of the story of Jesus changing water into wine in the Gospel of John at the marriage of Cana.
Yes.
It's the same aspect there, because there is so much evidence that the New Testament was trying to bring us back to the divine feminine. I think we have to say it failed catastrophically, but it was trying, because we have this whole aspect of Mary, the pure woman, the Parthenon, not necessarily virgin, but a woman in her own spirit, in her own power. And the very first miracle is when she leans across to her son and says, they have no wine. And he sort of snaps at her and says, woman, my time hasn't come. And she basically ignores him and turns to the servants and says, bring in the pots. So she's actually acting just like my mother chickens at the moment, saying to the babies, out you go, your turn. I'm empowering you. Get on with it, babe. I love that.
It's so absolutely hysterical that you've managed to bring that round to chickens, because I've been dying to jump in with chickens. So this was the other direction my mind was going when we were originally talking about parthenogenesis. And that is that the world is just far more magical than we mostly give it credence for. And this is not hearsay. I have witnessed this firsthand. Chickens can grow up, hens can grow up, can lay eggs, and then one day they can decide what's needed around here is a bit of the masculine, bit of maleness. And one of our chickens, who is definitely a hen, she definitely laid eggs, turned into a cockerel. And I know this is a known thing amongst chicken keepers. And as a cockerel, created baby chicks.
I have had exactly the same happen this year. We had
awesome.
I was given an egg because we had broody bantams and no cockerels. I was given several eggs, but only one of them hatched. And it was definitely a hen because we had three bantams, and one day there were four eggs, and the fourth one was absolutely titchy. She laid for about 2 weeks, and then she stopped laying, stood up a bit straighter, grew a tail, grew a wattle, grew a comb, turned into Scotty the cockerel, and now his, our transgender cockerel's first baby, was born last week.
Yay!
So yes, it absolutely is a thing, and there are plenty of species I think that do this if there is a necessity for it. So everything is, as you say, A, so much more magical than we think, and B, not driven by the physical reality of things. And that's what I think is so important for all of us to understand, especially now with all the ranting and conspiracy theories and stuff that you see on social media about the COVID-19 and governments and conspiracies and this, that and the other. It's all taking it from a place in the physical of what the evidence is in front of your faces. And that is the most fragile, least important aspect of any human being's life.
And that culturally, we only, you know, gosh, we're only just two by the sounds of it, but we do only seem to be now waking up to the understanding of just how utterly limited our perspective is, and that perspective can change almost every significant aspect of what you're viewing. You know, there's just where you stand to look at what you're looking at completely dictates your capacity to see what it is.
Absolutely, and that's basic quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
The observer changes what is observed.
Yes, exactly, on the greatest imaginable scale, and right down from the macro to the micro kind of thing.
I wonder if that's actually how prayer works, because I'm always working with the difference between prayer and healing and whether there actually is one. And as far as I take it, prayer doesn't change God, prayer changes me, which aligns me to the automatic divine love and abundance that's there. And I think when I pray for somebody else, there's some contact between us that helps to align them. But it may also be that when somebody is going, oh, please help me, oh, please help me, oh, please help me, so it can get into a bit of a habit or something, or you're just not at the psychological or spiritual level that the prayer may get further up, whereas somebody who's more detached, and sometimes you and I even work together on these things where I can help you when I'm detached from a situation that you're involved in, and you can help me when you're detached from a situation I'm involved in, because you can go clearly to look at the situation and maybe just alert the divine in a funny kind of way.
Yeah, yeah.
Just I mean, make that connection.
Sorry?
Just make that connection right rather than crooked.
Yes, and that's a fundamental aspect of being the hollow bone, which I think I've mentioned the concept of the hollow bone on this before. It's a beautiful Native American description of how it is to be a pure conduit for spirit, and therefore to be able to offer healing and prayers and transmissions in either direction, kind of to or from the divine, from life with a capital L to the rest of life, you know, because humans are part of life. But sometimes our perspective is such that we've forgotten that we're part of life and we've become disconnected from life. And the capacity to be truly the hollow bone, the hollow reed, the holy pipe, if you like, is that's completely predicated upon not being entangled in it. So your perspective being clarity rather than, to kind of overstate it somewhat, the kind of victimhood that we can sometimes get into, you know, when we're on our knees going, please, please, pleasey, please, for whatever it is, that is too often coming from that place of, I've forgotten that I've got any power in this. Mm-hmm. I sense, I mean, I might be being horrifically judgmental there and only revealing my own state, but, you know, it seems to me that you can't be the hollow bone for yourself that often because we tend to be entangled in that I need it or I'm so afraid I might not have it or whatever it is that our story is.
Only the greatest saints and sages can be the hollow bone for themselves. I've been reading up on St. John of the Cross, who was the soul mate of Teresa of Avila. Teresa was a converso, a Jew who converted to Christianity and then became a nun and wrote her amazing Entering the Castle, her amazing book on the seven levels of spiritual growth. But St. John of the Cross was thrown into jail for years and years on end, and he was in darkness in a room where he couldn't even stand up. And wow. The story of how he got through that, because basically he whittled out everything in the centre of his bone until he became a hollow bone. And when he was a hollow bone, somebody let him escape. But one of the things he did lying in this darkness was he wrote poetry and memorised it just to keep himself focused on not going down the plug hole. We're mixing metaphors here, but of course, whenever we're in great pain or great grief or great loss or great fear, we dive down that plug hole because our egos are so easily wired for fear, for fight or flight or freeze, one or the other. And it takes huge effort and discipline to start whittling your bone.
Whittling your bone, I like that.
Speaking of somebody who's just chewing on the end of hers, it's a long journey.
I feel like that could be an, you know, marvellous statement to make, you know, when I'm off to wander the hills, as it were. I'm just off to whittle me bone. See you later.
Sucking out the marrow.
Yes. Yeah, which is hopefully the good nourishing stuff to a degree, you know. I mean, we could
hopefully
twiddle around in endless ludicrous metaphors, really, but there is so much to be said for sucking on the marrow of our own bones. There's nourishment in there, and the more we examine what it is that is between us and the state of the hollow bone, so which is typically our kind of perhaps bizarre obsession with individuation in the West, or certainly our own kind of belief in separation and our lack of trust and our fear, and exactly as you said. And that when we take it all out into the light and have a jolly good look at it, we discover that, you know, potentially some of the things that we believe are not true. And immediately then the content of that bone is transformed into the most imaginably rich, nourishing soul food. So it's, you know, a bit of bone whittling. It's good for us all.
And here we are in the liminal time of COVID-19, which is the most perfect opportunity to start whittling these bones. It's fascinating. I'm going back to social media because I used to get all my comedy work from social media, and I still tend to go and look at it and see what I can do and how I can help and what I can learn from it. And there are definitely types of people emerging here. There's the ones who are all baking sourdough, and I admit I am one of those. I'm trying to bake sourdough and still failing. I'm baking bread, but boy, it's a journey on the sourdough, blimey. So there are those who are doing more, learning more, addressing new things. That's part of the liminal time, to look for the new. There are those who are lonely and bored, and that's part of the liminal time. That's part of the important time of the dark night of the soul. And there are those who are just simply yearning to go back to where we were and grieving because we aren't going to go back to where we were. And again, that's liminal, the grief, the learning, the boredom, the disconnection. It's what we actually do with it afterwards, which I think is going to matter to us. How we get through it is completely individual to all of us. But the longer this goes on, and it the extension is until, I think, May the 3rd at the moment, which is the full 40 days of quarantine.
Mm.
So it will be very interesting to see what happens after that. And also they're now saying that we may never get rid of this disease. We don't know. The Spanish flu just vanished after the plague, after the First World War. And the whole thing is, we don't know. And so many people are shouting that people should know, that the government should know. Of course they shouldn't know. This is unprecedented.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. These are the most extraordinary times. The thing I've been struck by the most forcibly is the very, very common thread, certainly amongst the people I know, of I'm so tired. And it really, really struck me the other day that, of course, people are tired. We're in grief, and grief is exhausting.
Mm.
And I think pretty nearly everybody is in some flavour of grief, whether it's grief because you want it to go back to how it was, grief because you can't bear the thought of it going back to how it was, grief because you're distanced from your loved ones, grief because your loved ones are ill or dying, grief because you desperately need a hug. You know, I could go on and on and on. There are so many reasons to grieve. But my point is that there's at least one reason to grieve for every single one of us.
Mm.
And I think as a society, we had our head jammed up our consumerist little backside, excuse me, so completely before that the kind of majority shopfront window, if you like, of our society wasn't facing its grief. I think, you know, us hippy dippies were fully in grief about the state of the world, but I think grief has now come to visit even those who were simply singing with their fingers in their ears around
yes,
mass extinction and climate change. And so, yeah, we're knackered. We're yes, facing our grief.
We are facing our grief. And it's important that we do. Stephen Jenkinson, the wonderful teacher from Orphan Wisdom who works with the dying, says that if you aren't in the sorrow of the world, you aren't awake. Because
yeah,
all of life feeds on death. There is always death. This morning I found that I'd mistaken a buzzing sound. I thought it was a fly in the window and I didn't bother to save it, and I found out it was a bee and I grieved. And then I said to myself, why was one life more important than the other? You weren't willing to save anything at that point, and grieved for myself for that.
Yes. Yeah.
It is a fascinating time, and we are actually very privileged to be doing this podcast at this time, even if I can't sit with you and I can hear the bird song around you, but I can't go outside because we don't have a signal outside on Dartmoor.
Yeah, it is. I love the beautiful balance of that. I can't do it inside because we don't have a signal inside.
Right, well, We did talk earlier about the Zakor of well-being and agreed that we'd include this in. This is something that my bishop is sending round. He's a wonderful man. He's a mystic and an alchemist and a wise child, if you know what I mean. And he is sending round these Hebrew words, which are ancient Hebrew words for the relief of karma from a plague. And if we say these words, it is a way of asking for the right outcome and as much healing as possible during this pandemic. And he I don't know where he found it from. He keeps his sources very close to himself. He is an esoteric teacher, whereas I'm a mesoteric teacher. I'm the one who sort of links people between the worlds. And he said that, of course, COVID-19 was coming. You can't have spiritual leaders all around the world praying for the earth without something happening. So the Zakor of Wellbeing, I'm putting it up with a link to David's page and a link to the PDF if anybody wants to do it. But the idea is just to intone some Hebrew words once a day or before you go out shopping or on behalf of somebody you love. And it's just an ancient theurgy, sacred magic. It's and like the Mass, it's a very old tradition that is heard by angelic ears, if you like. It's got only two Hebrew words in it that I recognize, one of which is Malek, which is angel, and the other is Elyon, which is the divine feminine. So this is calling on the divine mother through her angels to heal the karma that has caused this plague. And I think that's rather beautiful.
It is beautiful.
So I'll say it if I may.
Go on then.
Very bad pronunciation. I apologise for this, but if you want, it's written out phonetically on David's page. So if you're interested, go to the Podbean site and click on the link. He's got 80,000 people reciting it every day within a week. So hopefully we can build on that. And it goes like this. Amasha naluku shahaiya malek razon elyon pe. And the loud pe at the end is the ejaculation, if you like, to send it, as an amen is also. So anybody listening that, I hope it's a blessing for you. And please, if you like it, go download it.
So it's called to my immediate vicinity two enormous ravens who are flying around squawking. I don't know if you can hear them, but they're huge and raggedly black, dancing on the air above me. They're beautiful. Just to the technical a moment, please could you also, under our Podbean thing, add a link to Stephen Jenkinson's work? Because if you don't know his work, it's beautiful and extraordinary and powerfully necessary, I would suggest, in these times.
Absolutely. And both
these... your next words are about to tell me that we've talked for too long.
Not too long, but we're in our half hour. But yes, both David and Stephen are shining examples of the masculine in tune with the feminine. And neither of them takes prisoners. And that is actually one of the signs that I've found of the true divine feminine. She doesn't take prisoners.
That's, yes, in my little world, that's crone energy for you.
Yeah. Well, two crones signing off, and we'll see you again next week.
Lots of love, Maggie.
And see you, Susie.